Although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it.
That was Hillary Clinton in 2008, conceding the Democratic Party nomination to Barack Obama. Last week, a lot of people thought they'd wake up the morning after the election to our nation's first ever Madam President. But alas, here is Hillary Clinton once again conceding the 2016 race, this time to Donald Trump.
I know we have still not shattered that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but someday someone will, and hopefully sooner than we might think right now. And to all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Today, in light of last week's election, we're talking about women in government. My guest is Wendy Doyle. Hi, Wendy.
Good morning.
You are the president and CEO of the Women's Foundation of Kansas City. What exactly does that entail? Explain, just to set this up, a little bit about the work you do.
Sure. The Women's Foundation, we promote equity and opportunity for women of all ages. And how we go about that is we use research, we come up with some solutions, and then we really focus on results. We're an organization that, think of us as a think tank, where the research helps us to develop policy solutions that will impact women and their families in Missouri and Kansas.
What kinds of policy decisions?
We are really focused on economic development. So issues as it relates to putting dollars and cents back into household budgets, but also to help drive the economy in both states too.
Why do you do this work?
We do this work because there obviously is a need based on the introduction, and one of the areas that we really see where we can make the greatest progress is not only to focus on these policy issues, but also women in leadership and women in leadership civically. And so we see there's a long way to go. And so that's why the Women's Foundation exists and why our work is so important.
Why does it matter for women to be represented in civic positions?
You know, women's voices need to be heard, first and foremost, but secondly, to it brings a unique perspective to the table in so many situations where it is primarily male dominant around the table. And so when you have a balance, then you come up with some solutions that it may not have been thought of with the men around the table. So it just brings a unique perspective and point of view.
Can you explain that a little more? Because I think a lot of people might believe that, you know, that women's issues are the same as anyone else's, that everyone wants a strong economy, that everyone wants good health care access. The list goes on. But in what way does a woman's perspective perhaps differ, or just, you know, why is it different?
So first and foremost, you know, women represent the population. We are a majority of the population. And so, you know, that has to be taken into consideration. But secondly, Women's Foundation, we actually spent quite a bit of time listening to women, you know, of all income levels, and men too. And believe it or not, the same issues that women are concerned about, men are concerned about too. So it is pretty equitable in the issues that we all want to solve. And when you have, knowing that it's equitable, you need to have equity at the table too. And I think that is what we are striving for.
So you've just referenced this, but I mean, one of the things you've put in place is a series of listening sessions. You've gone to different locations in Kansas City, Springfield, and St. Louis to hear what women are concerned about today. What kinds of things have you been hearing over and over again? Anything surprising?
You know, really nothing surprising, but I think nothing surprising, but also surprising at the same time. And what I mean by that is, you know, so much concern about household budgets. And it's interesting that men are very concerned about, as I said, the same issues. So child care was number one of all income levels. Obviously, low income was accessibility. Mid to upper income was quality. A second issue was health care. Again, low income accessibility for women and their families. Mid to upper income, preventative health as well as mental health, aging economic security, income and employment, and then we focused on civic leadership too. So those kind of are our big issue areas, and that what we talked about in all of these listening sessions with men and women around the state.
Is a glass ceiling in government or elsewhere something that you've heard about in those sessions?
Yes, and it was really interesting. You know, first, just to put in perspective, 25% of the General Assembly is represented by women in both Missouri and Kansas. And actually, Missouri slid a little bit with the August primary, and it's down to 23%. But women really want, men and women, I will say, really want more women represented in the General Assembly. A lot of women, you know, are very scared and concerned about what it would mean to actually run for office.
What do you mean by that?
There is so much scrutiny in the media, and I think that really scares off a lot of good and qualified potential candidates to step forward. And scrutiny meaning, you know, lots of discussion, all income levels of why would I want to jeopardize my family, to be put under a microscope, to really be, you know, evaluated or, you know, judged.
Why do you think women respond to that with a different kind of fear, though? Do you think that that is in part the example of what they've seen in national politics?
I think so. Absolutely. And I think, you know, coming off of this extremely divisive election, I think now more than ever that could be heightened in women's minds. But it was still interesting that even though that women felt that way, they still wanted to see, and they would be supportive of other women candidates if they stepped forward and they were representing them appropriately. So although they themselves would not put themselves forward, they still see the value and the importance of having women at the table.
What do you think of this whole, like, embracing of the pantsuit among women who feel disaffected in this moment? I mean, that talk about Hillary Clinton and her choice of attire used to be very mocking, and I'm sure it still is in many circles, but there are women out there who, in spite of fashion trends, have embraced the pantsuit as a symbol of their solidarity with Hillary Clinton and with women in leadership positions more generally. What do you think of that? Because when you talk about scrutiny, outward appearance is a big part of that for women.
And this was something that was really discussed significantly in these focus groups. And women said, you know, I don't want to be judged on how long my hair is, how short my hair is. Am I wearing hosiery or not? Is my heel height too high or too low? I mean, those were the concerns, and those are the things that are scrutinized and brought out for candidates versus the words that they say, you know, the heart and the mind that they lead with, you know, the quality and character of the potential candidate. And it's all just this outward appearance that's being judged. And, you know, that is something that I think as a society we really need to work on to overcome.
Is there any evidence in the research that you've either done or come across that women in office or women in civic positions in a very particular way represent the concerns of the women in the communities they serve?
We didn't dig that deep into our research study. We more or less were just getting a temperature check of civic engagement just across the board and interest. But we definitely see the value, you know, definitely.
What would you say to women out there who come election time want to be able to vote for candidates based really specifically on issues without regard to whether the candidate is a woman or not? Is there a case to be made that having a woman in office is just on its own significant to the women out there in the population?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in your introduction again, you know, the speaking to girls is really important, that we really need to start to set the example so for our future generation, they see a clear pathway. And that's really another reason that we are working so hard at this. You know, Women's Foundation invested in, took a, you know, a little bit, a deeper slice at this on why women aren't more civically engaged. And the research study found that women really want to be asked to serve, that women hold back. We tend to undervalue our experience and expertise and qualifications. But yet, if someone asked us, would you be willing to step up and serve? We would be the first to say, absolutely, I'll be there for you. So that is something that as an organization that we are working on, we really are out.
On extending those invitations.
And extending those invitations and asking women to step up and serve and getting them comfortable feeling that they do have the qualifications in place through training programs and education.
What about you out there? Do you think it's important to see women represented in government? Call 816-235-2888 to tell us why or why not. So, you know, we talked about some of the reasons why we don't see more women in office last week. Although there were women who lost local elections, women did pick up 4 seats in the Kansas House and 2 seats in the Kansas Senate. What do you think is the significance of that?
You know what? I will commend Kansas. I think very organized in their efforts and collectively coming together and supporting one another. And I think that is a big significant piece of our research is showing that mentoring is something that's really important. I think as women, we have to reach back and help extend a hand and lift up. And I think you saw results of that in Kansas, that the women there, the women candidates, they supported one another. They were organized and the results showed.
Can you give an example of how they worked together?
They work together in, you know, being a resource, being those who are in elected office made themselves available to those candidates that were running for office. They made introductions and they helped them navigate the, you know, fundraising campaign process. So they really had the grassroots work in place in the playbook that is necessary or mind sharing to be able to share with the potential running candidates.
Do you see the idea of just local representation, gains in local representation being encouraging, or is this just essentially really consistent with the idea of what a glass ceiling is? The idea being that you can achieve anything up to a certain level. In this case, those highest positions, you know, if you climb the ladder high enough at some point, I'm just going to call it like it is. I mean, it's dudes. In this case, we're talking about the presidency.
Right. I think every incremental step that we can make with progress is a success and something that should be celebrated. And I commend the efforts in Kansas. There's equal efforts in Missouri, too, that we must start at the grassroots level. And one thing to share just in what the Women's Foundation is doing to be able to help support that is we have what is called an appointments project. And the appointments project is really to encourage women to apply through our website. So, you know, self-selecting or raising their hand, or if we ask them to, step forward and make themselves known that they want to become civically engaged. And then we work with mayors across both states and governors in Missouri and Kansas to help get women appointed to boards and commissions. And this is what we feel is a first step in an effort, a grassroots effort, to helpfully get women comfortable with civic engagement and want to run for office.
Let's hear from one of our callers at 816-235-2888. We've got Kim in Mission on the line. Hi, Kim.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I feel like there has been a shattering of the ceiling, and the perspective that I'm holding is that I always wanted to run for office. I always have cared and been involved in my children's schools and in my community, but I stayed hidden because I felt ashamed of some things I had in my past. But because we've recently elected Trump as president, I have no shame. There's no reason for me to feel shame for anything if a man like this can be in leadership, then why can't I? I never tried to hurt anybody. The experiences I had were more of a spiritual nature, and I was concerned that they wouldn't be understood by the public. But now I feel like I could have a platform to really enlighten people around my own spiritual journey and how that's fed into my power as a woman and the way that I want to help serve my community.
So in a way, you feel like some of the things that Donald Trump has in his own past kind of free you of that sense that you're going to, that you won't hold up under scrutiny.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I have to laugh because it's just absolute insanity that there is a man admitting to sexually assaulting women in the position of president-elect. I don't understand, but I also feel very empowered in the sense that I've never committed a crime. The things that I've experienced really were through the lens of, you know, adolescence and college and exploration.
Well, Kim, thank you for that perspective. And that's one that I haven't heard before, but it's certainly interesting.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, what I like about what Kim said is that, you know, she has wanted to do it, and now she is empowered to step up and do so. But how she described, you know, holding back because of something that may have happened in our past, that is what we have heard time and time again in our focus groups. And not only that, but even at the grassroots level of boards and commissions, women hold back. And if there's anything, as she said, to learn from what we just experienced in the election, is that don't hold back. It's you know, you bring so much value to the table. It's time to raise your hand and step forward.
You've talked in this conversation about the importance of role models. You are a president and CEO of an organization, and I wonder about your role models. I mean, did you just naturally come by the confidence to pursue the level of career that you have, or did you have help along the way as well?
You know, I have had two very important role models that I look up to, and one was my grandmother and one was my mother, and both helped raise me and taught me all along the way that I could be anything that I wanted to be, and really kept me empowered throughout my entire, you know, growing up into adulthood and into my career. My grandmother in the 1950s had her own business, and she was an accountant, and so she was in a male-dominant industry. My mother took over her business too. So very strong, empowered women who really just were the hand on the back to keep me moving forward.
Do you think that role modeling is more, I mean, you're talking, there's a difference in some way between role modeling and mentoring or encouraging. Role modeling really is, I see you doing this, and therefore I know that I can do it too. And in some ways, I see how I can do it. Do you think that that's an important distinction? Because you're talking about real direct encouragement and like rock that's there for you, and that's important. But what about this role modeling piece of it?
Absolutely. And to take it a little deeper, I think that was more of what I received than the mentoring, of course, the encouragement. But I had the opportunity to witness, you know, these strong women in my life that navigated working in a male-dominant industry, or how to break through in a small way their glass ceiling in their own communities. And so that is what I had the opportunity to witness. That's what I really think that we need to do for our girls, is that we really need to role model and navigate in an appropriate manner.
Do you remember like a moment that you witnessed that really sent a powerful message to you?
Yes, I would say, you know, a male client who is extremely successful, business owner, sitting down and asking, because of the trust that was developed between my mother and him, asking a really difficult question and taking advice and counsel from her, when I know that that had probably been one of the first times he'd ever done that in his career.
Let's talk with Jonathan. Jonathan's calling from Independence. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
What can you share?
So I was wanting to answer your question about whether I wanted to see more women in power or, well, in leadership in general. And I thought that, we definitely need to, because we have a lot of dads right now and we need more moms, basically. And maybe it's an American culture thing, but dads tend to be more heavy-handed in America and moms tend to be a bit more compromising and empathetic. And I think we need that right now in our leadership for sure.
I'm really interested in this comment because I feel two ways about it. I mean, on the one hand, seeing that women maybe bring special qualities to the table that shouldn't be overlooked or devalued, I find that meaningful. At the same time, the expectation that women are going to function really specifically as mother figures out in the world and their jobs among their peers, that's quite an expectation.
It's a great, it's a huge expectation. And I just want to comment, too, on the caller, the father, you know, what we've heard time and time again is so many men are supportive of the work that we're doing because they have daughters. They have wives that are trying to, you know, break that glass ceiling or to elevate into their corporate positions. And so they want to be a part of this. But, you know, to have a working mom and trying to work and also be a mom, it is extremely, extremely challenging. And we hear that time and time again. And you know, the what we see as women in the C-suite, sometimes women are not, that's not what they aspire to. They, definition of may having it all may be being a good mom and being a middle manager, and that's just fine.
Something that we did see in the Democratic National Convention this year was, I heard the message about Hillary Clinton that the emphasis was really on her work for women and children, which corresponded to her background in so many ways. But that seemed like a deliberate strategy to present, here's this strong woman aspiring to power, but don't worry. It's in this kind of, it's in a way that isn't threatening. It's in this very maternal capacity.
Right. And how, and packaging that so that it comes across, you know, in a way that we can all relate to, I think is important and is, I think, a lesson learned from the campaign and something that as women are in elected office or moving forward that we could learn and use that because that is an important part to kind of package that, being able to relate to women and their families.
Do you see there being, I mean, in your listening sessions, you've talked about different income levels of women and all sorts of differences. I'm interested in different generations of women and how they perceive one another. And because I think that is also something that came up in this election, is that it took a while for younger women to see Hillary Clinton as someone who spoke for them, who represented them.
I think it's, you know, both ways. Young struggled, but also old struggled. But then some old were very excited and supportive and some young supportive, too. So I think it was, you know, the back and forth, you know, across all age spectrums and ethnicities. So you saw some absolutely in favor, some not so. And I think, again, it really, you know, I took a moment to just have some conversations with some of those in the aging population. And I really think it goes back to how they were raised. You know, those who were less supportive of a potential woman president were really had strong father figures. Those with strong mother figures felt less, you know, were more supportive. So I think, you know, it really goes back to how you were raised.
What comes next in your mind? I mean, what do you think are the biggest challenges ahead for women in civic life?
You know, I think the biggest obstacle is getting women to actually run for office based on what we've already talked about is just the scrutiny in the media for themselves and or their families. And I think that is the one obstacle that continues. We've heard time and time again, hold women back, coupled with the fear of fundraising and the amount of money that it actually takes to run for office. So I would say if there's anything that we can do, it's encouragement and again, that mentoring and supporting and surrounding these women with the tools and resources in order for them to be successful.
Wendy Doyle, CEO and President of the Women's Foundation of Kansas City, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to end this conversation with the song Queen by Janelle Monáe. When Central Standard returns from the break, we'll be talking about the local implications of the Dakota Access Pipeline. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now on KCUR's Central Standard, we're turning our attention to the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is supposed to eventually carry about 470,000 barrels of oil a day from western North Dakota to Illinois. The people who support that project point to the jobs it would provide and to increased energy independence. There have been ongoing protests over the project, though, and the vocal opposition has to do with both environmental concerns and solidarity with Native communities most directly affected by the project. For more on that, let's talk to John Reyna. He's a local man with family in Standing Rock, where this is all coming to a head. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and why the possible construction of a pipeline under the Missouri River in North Dakota matters to you.
It matters very much because it has direct impact on my own family. My mother, my siblings all live on Standing Rock and right at the Missouri River. Where they want to cross is just north of the boundary of the reservation, but was strategically chosen over another route, which was initially proposed.
Through Bismarck, right?
North of Bismarck, yes.
North of Bismarck.
But also because I live downriver here in Kansas City. So I also have my family here and my granddaughter here, as well as plenty of friends, relatives, and time spent here where I know there's the potential for direct impact here in Kansas City.
So for people who maybe don't understand why Native communities are in a bit of upheaval over this possibility of this pipeline passing through the northern extension of the Missouri River where it's proposed to do, can you unpack that for us a little bit?
Sure. So part of understanding what's happening is knowing your history. And for us, what some people don't realize in modern America is that the Great Sioux Nation was comprised of seven bands and was one of the nations that the United States signed treaties with to allow for westward expansion. They signed a treaty in 1851 and also signed a treaty in 1868. So what some may not understand is that the Lakota, along with many other indigenous tribes, were the predecessor sovereign. So they are a freestanding nation that made a treaty with this country. And some of those conditions of the treaties and the boundaries of the treaties were disregarded by the United States in the subsequent years. But those boundaries, some pieces of those treaties, they're part of the American Constitution. So they are the law of the land. They were ratified by the Congress. They were signed by the executive office. So those are the ruling law of the land. And it is following the rule of law to abide by those treaties. And as we see Native communities, and especially the Sioux, the Lakota people, the Dakota people, Nakota people, as we see them continue to be dispossessed for the energy needs or for other resource needs, it's very difficult because there was in the 20th century, not only were they limited in their land base, but also the Army Corps of Engineers was instrumental in damming the river to create hydroelectric power needs in North and South Dakota. So there's a series of dams that were placed, and there were whole communities that were flooded and underwater. And this is as recent as the 1950s and 60s. My mother remembers around age 10 that this happened, and they saw their entire town get moved. And so this is not just something new. This is a continual episode in the dispossession of Native communities for the energy and resource needs.
You mentioned the Army Corps of Engineers, and in fact, just yesterday, the Army Corps of Engineers sent a letter that I mean, people have been waiting since about September to hear from the Army Corps of Engineers on this. The project, the Dakota Access Pipeline, to move forward needs an easement that's permission from the Corps in order to drill under a lake on the Missouri River to finish the pipeline along its proposed route. And just yesterday, that letter came, but it says that construction, quote, cannot occur because the Army has not made a final decision on whether to grant an easement. And also it said that they would be working with the Standing Rock Sioux on a timeline that allows for robust discussion and analysis. Does having Native communities and Indigenous people invited to the table on that, does that feel significant to you, or are you interpreting that differently?
I think that there's always been a critical understanding of a treaty and also upholding the Constitution as being in part of this land. There has to be those contractual interactions and really nation to nation interactions. But I think that for the Army Corps, they are probably looking at their historical record, knowing that the tribe has presented that you have had a major hydroelectric disposition that's happened just in the last 50, 60 years. And so I think that that plays a big part in their obligation to listen, because it is not as if it's one tribe maybe who's removed from a river or removed from some other resource who's not losing land base. This is yet again another insult and dispossession that's happening to the Sioux Nation.
It's not just the Sioux that's been vocally opposing this project. A lot of tribes have been coming together in opposition to this project. Does that feel historic to you on some level?
Very much so. I would tell you that I was present at the camp for about 10 days in September, and there were ceremonies and there were welcomings of distant tribes, historical enemies, in tribal nations who were providing donations and food and support, but also formal resolutions and efforts to convey support, both in written, oral, all means. And so I do think that when you have elder people who are 80 years old saying they've never seen a gathering like this, I think the reality is that there has never been a gathering of all of the Western Hemisphere tribes. There have been representatives come from Ecuador. So we are seeing an awakening, an important awakening, I think, of the Indigenous people. And really, it's very much a historic time.
How did you get involved in the local organizing efforts around this?
So I myself have been in Kansas City for numerous years, and after coming back from home and talking to my relatives, one of the things that we've always done is pray. And so I chose to go to a gathering locally here, and there were a group of people that I had never met before that I chose to take the Standing Rock flag that my mother gave me and go and share prayer. I took some sacramentals with me. I took some sage and some sweet grass and went to the river, because there was a local group of people who stand in solidarity. And many of those people I've stayed in immediate contact with and have participated in some donation drives with them. And always,
you went to pray?
Yeah.
Did you see that as a political action, or did you see that as a personal spiritual action, or is that indistinguishable?
Well, I think in our modern context, we tend to want to compartmentalize things, or we want to have our basically our game face or what have you. I think it's more important to have a unity of your person. And so for myself, having genuine prayer, being sincere and doing that for the greater good was really why I was there.
What specifically were you praying for, if you don't mind my asking? I know that's in some ways really personal.
So I was raised in a culture where we know that Unchi Maka, that is our grandmother Earth, is who gives us life in a material way, you know, in a substantial way, sustains us. But more than anything, the water is the essence of life for every part of the creation. And so when that starts to become at risk, when you start to understand, we are from a culture where when you were mobile or you were camped away from the river, people who have to haul water, when you haul it in a bucket, you understand the importance of every single drop. And so to go and pray at the river and help people understand who are now in a modern American culture, the sacredness of the water, the sacredness of the land, the sacredness of all of the plants, and our human responsibility to be stewards with that.
Can you talk to me more? I mean, you just referenced carrying buckets of water, and that isn't a reality that most Americans today have experienced. But access to water, I mean, those issues play out very differently on reservations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Many of the tribes, not so much, you know, the Standing Rock, but the Dene in Arizona, there are still places where they have to have water brought in. So the importance of it as a resource, I think what many people don't understand is that for this energy pipeline for oil and fracking to take place, it's a hydraulic process and they're using water. And so we're at a place where they're choosing to use 53 million gallons last year in 2015 alone. And so I think water for all of us is an important consideration.
When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll continue this discussion about the Dakota Access Pipeline, specifically its passage under a section of the Missouri River in North Dakota. If that matters to you here in Kansas City, call to tell us why. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. We've been talking with a local Lakota man, John Reyna, whose family is in Standing Rock, about the cultural significance of a contested pipeline that I'm sure people have heard a lot about. Now let's hear from environmental science professor Daniel Wildcat, with us from Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How about you?
Doing well.
Explain for our listeners some of the environmental concerns related to the Dakota Access Pipeline, especially as they pertain to us here. I mean, we are on the Missouri River as well.
Right, right. Well, you know, first I want to thank John for doing a very excellent job of, in a very short period of time, sort of giving a historical and really a constitutional kind of overview of the issue as it's facing the Standing Rock Nation. I think from an environmental perspective, the issues are so palpable. I think, remember, the water protectors there, they're not protesters, they are protectors there, have denominated that they're really motto they is water is life. And I think that what's resonating with a lot of people is that people are beginning to recognize the foolishness and the incredible potential danger that could happen, not just to the water in if a pipeline either under or going over the Missouri River were to break. I think, you know, they're beginning to recognize that very pipeline is to continue a carbon energy source that we are increasingly seeing create incredible havoc on the planet to our environments.
Can I get you to back up, though?
Yeah.
You mentioned the danger of a pipeline, the pipeline breaking under the river in mm-hmm. that close of proximity to the water carried by the Missouri River. Can you explain really specifically what the danger is there? What would the result of that be?
It'd make the water unusable for any human use, agricultural use, for drinking, and think of the affect, you know, incredible downstream. This could be a potential hazard from the point of the break clear to the Gulf of Mexico. And I think the magnitude of that is something that, people are beginning to grab hold of. And I think it's resonating with a lot of people. So this is to say nothing of the aquatic life in the river, which, again, many people take very seriously and value the flora and fauna of the Missouri River. So there's no way in which you can imagine, if there were to be this kind of break, that it would be anything short of catastrophic for the life in the river and for the humans that all live along the river and depend on that water.
When we talk about
and
the
I would
humans,
argue,
I just am kind of interested. I mean, people who support the pipeline talk about jobs, for example. How do you respond to those concerns, thinking about how this project will affect people one way or the other?
Well, I think we all want jobs. I mean, I think people want jobs. People want to be able to support their families. Again, I think one of the things that is interesting about the Dakota Access Pipeline and the movement that's been led by Indigenous people at this point is that people are beginning to make the connection and say, yeah, jobs are an issue, but there's a lot of work that could be done both in our native communities and throughout the Midwest to really build, with the current technology we have today, renewable energy sources. And this might be this one issue here that sort of brings into focus the opportunity we have to do something different in terms of energy future.
Daniel, I want to jump in so that we can hear from some of our listeners. We've got a lot of calls, and I'm interested in hearing from Janet in Kansas City. Janet, what do you have to share with us on this topic?
I am so thankful that this is happening, that you have this on the program, and that the Indigenous people are gathering, and I have been in prayer and in thought with them. I was raised on a farm in Marshall County, Kansas. I know what hauling buckets of water is, and I know what saving water is. And 50 years ago, my dad was saying, you know, if they don't quit pumping water out of the aquifer to irrigate fields in western Kansas, that aquifer is going to run dry. And it has.
So, Janet, this is... Thank you for that call. This is really interesting because... I mean, from a very different perspective, I mean, Dan and John, I'm interested. Are you surprised to hear that someone is able to see in a Kansas farming background a relationship to what's happening to the aquifer and what's happening on the Missouri River? I'll start with you, John.
No, I think that what you have to recognize, we say that it's historic in the Indigenous people gathering. But there are a tremendous number of people from all walks of life, from every race, that are there in those prayer camps. But even more so, why there's so much awareness in social media and why there's so much direct action and really common sense approach to it is that we really get it about water. I think, you know, our mass education now from an elementary school level, where we know the importance and the basic necessity of water, has really united us in this awareness.
Dan, what about you?
Yeah, I think absolutely that one of the things is resonating is that people across the planet are in situations, not abstract situations, real everyday situations where they're recognizing that how crucial our relationship, our human relationship and the life relationship to water is. And they're seeing time after time water being polluted, water being used. Even just think about the way that waste drilling, wastewater is being injected into the earth. And we have the whole fracking issue. I mean, this is really making people rethink how we appreciate, honor, and respect water. And I think this is really becoming a global issue.
Let's hear from Beth in Kansas City, Kansas. Beth, we don't have a lot of time, so quickly ask your question or share your story.
Yes, hello?
Hi.
Yes, thank you. What I'm curious about is, has the local media spoken with Governor Brownback? Because some years back, he felt an urge to make a public pronouncement about the apology for Kansas and the Trail of Tears, so that the Native Americans were quite important and are the quote-unquote white man's violation. So here is an opportunity. And so if one was not to be cynical about Kansas Brownback and his Christianity, what has he, what is his opportunity now to say about the Native American sovereignty? Thank you.
Thanks, Beth. I personally do not know the answer to this question. I wonder what our guests might have to say about their possible knowledge of Governor Brownback's position on this.
I think that Governor Brownback is in a position of authority along with Governor Dalrymple in North Dakota. And unfortunately, sometimes those positions of leadership are skewed by economic interests, corporate interests. And so it would be a keen opportunity for him to separate those two things. And if there is a genuine historical forgiveness and trauma that needs to be relieved from the leadership standpoint, for him to write a resolution or to convey messages of solidarity would definitely be welcome, I think, from the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Recently, the mayor of Kansas City, along with the city council, did draft a resolution and have sent that to the president as well as to the Standing Rock Sioux. So I think there's tremendous opportunity at this juncture with this awakening for those things to occur.
John, how would you say that environmental concerns and the concerns of indigenous communities intersect here? I mean, the concerns of indigenous communities beyond environmental, how do they connect to the environmental? Does that make sense?
Sure. I think that you have to look at the cultural difference. I think that unfortunately we sometimes see a rolling up or kind of just a lumping together of monetary gain or capitalism, I guess, is what we refer to it as, an American mode in mainstream America. I'm not exempt. We have to have exchange of monetary goods, but in Indian culture, those sacred things, those sacramentals, the way that they offered, the way the economy functioned, it was all a relationship to the creatures and the creation around. So I come from the Lakota, who were a buffalo culture. One of the things that the army did immediately under the new system of colonialization was they wiped out the buffalo. So it was our resource and our livelihood that changed, and it became a different economic relationship.
You know, speaking, there was this meme kind of online, the photo of buffalo congregating near the site of the protest and the proposed site of the pipeline construction. How did you feel about the way that our culture broadly viewed that event, the arrival of these buffalo? Because I was not really sure that everything I was hearing about that significance was like ringing true from necessarily the cultural perspective of indigenous people.
So you may or may not have seen recently that all of those buffalo were herded and penned and kept in an area where they weren't able to freely roam and get food anymore, and were taken off in tractor trailers and removed. But certainly that kinship to all wildlife, along with the plant life, will never change for the Lakota people. They will be there. We will continue to be there. We will always be there.
Our time is up for this discussion, but keep talking about this. We're on Twitter at KCURCST. John Reyna, thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Appreciate it.
And Daniel Wildcat, thank you too, talking to us from Haskell Indian Nations University.
You bet. Thank you.
This conversation, like everything you hear on Central Standard, will be available for download later today. You can get it at kcur.org/centralstandard, and you'll have a link that you can send to your friends as well. Tomorrow, the effects of climate change on the Midwest, not on glaciers, not on New York or California, on the place where we live. That's tomorrow on this show. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, and Jen Chen. Our interns are Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date. That's coming up next.